Hello there. You are listening to Two People. My name is Blaine Lay, and if you're a longtime listener, hello again. Old friend, welcome back. If you're a first-time listener, thanks for being here. Each episode on the show, we talk to someone from around town about who they are, their personal experience, and then how that comes to life in the work that they do. Today on the show, I sit down with Courtney Lynch. She serves on the Board of Supervisors in Henrico County, representing the Brooklyn District. So I want to give you some context. For years in Henrico, at the Board of Supervisor level, the balance of power was in favor of the Republicans, 3-2. There were 5 seats, each seat representing a district. And I want you to imagine like a seesaw on a playground, right? On the one side, you've got 3 Republicans. They've got the weight. And on the other side, you've got 2 Democrats. Last year, a longtime Republican member passed away and a seat opens up. So all of a sudden, you've got 2 people on each side. We don't know which way it's going to go. And so there was, in the election in November, there was just a lot of focus to figure out who is going to win this crucial 5th seat. The winner would add that 3rd person to their side of the seesaw, adding some weight. And the other party would be like kind of stuck up in the air with their legs dangling, if you can imagine that. Our guest on the show today, Courtney Lynch, a Democrat, won that election. The balance of power has now shifted. In Henrico County, it is now 3-2 Democrat Republican. But if you listen, I think she sees herself less as a member of a political party, right? She's more than just a letter behind her name. And we cover a lot of ground in our conversation, from her time as a ski bum to her time in the Marines to eventually starting her own leadership consulting business. She talks us through what motivated her to run for office, her battle for that seat. And you might remember there were a series of racially charged attack mailers that went out targeting her. And yes, we talk about those as well. She talks about what makes her unique on the board.
Today, I'm only the 2nd woman ever to serve on the Board of Supervisors. I'm the youngest member, and I'm also the only mom of school-age children.
And she also shares a bit of advice for women in particular.
At times, women focus on what they can't do without recognizing what they can do. And, you know, I'm not a rocket scientist. I mean, I think the only thing that maybe makes me a little special is that courage and that willingness to try.
This is episode 35 with Courtney Lynch. You're listening to Two People. Courtney Lynch, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Blaine, for having me.
Appreciate you making the time. We're excited to have you. So I wanted to start, I know that you grew up in Fairfax.
I did.
And your parents worked in county government?
Yes, right? Yes, they did. So I'm blessed to have 3 parents. I have an amazing stepmother and an awesome mother. My mother passed away. It's been over 10 years now. So I really was raised by a village. And yes, so 2 of my awesome great parents worked in local government. And my mom worked in just government in general as a cost accountant.
Okay. And did your dad work on the Planning Commission?
Yes, is that right? So my dad was the executive director of Fairfax County's Planning Commission from 1970 to 1998.
Oh, wow.
And I mentioned the years because that was an era of explosive growth for Fairfax County and the greater Washington, D.C. region. So it's wonderful to have learned literally at his knee as a child, driving around, looking at sites, talking about development.
What would you guys talk about when you were driving around?
We talked about zoning and land use. And you know, he literally would explain it to me step by step. And I'll admit it didn't come full circle until I was in law school and studying property law and land use at that perspective. I started to connect the dots of what my father had taught me. Yet my dad was just always focused on doing his best and making those tough decisions. I mean, he would be the signature on the eminent domain letters, and people would stop him in the grocery store all the time to share their often not so positive thoughts about how development was going. Yet he really stood tall and was a true servant. And that's what I really appreciate about my dad. He just really cared about people and adding value to the community.
I love the image of you like driving around as a 12-year-old, like pointing out the window,
talking exactly about zoning law and land use. That's exactly what it was. And I mean, it goes, I mean, yeah, it was, and he made it so fun. I mean, my dad's a really great, jovial guy. And so I could, you know, I don't think at the time I knew that he was getting work and time with his kid done at the same time,
yeah.
Right?
But killing 2 birds with 1 stone.
Yep. Now looking back, I know that I was riding shotgun on some professional drive-bys that he was doing.
Yeah. What was, growing up, what was your perception of your parents' public service, and how did that shape you?
My perception of it was that they just cared deeply about the community. I don't know if I got the whole public service tie, yet that they were just very interconnected to the community. My dad, again, in particular, my mom's more shy and reserved, but my dad was always engaging. And, you know, we used to joke that we didn't like to go out with my dad because he would introduce you to 10 people and always was proud of his kids and telling your story and hearing other people's stories. Yet as I got older, I started to actually really enjoy that. So it was really just his sense of interconnectedness that I think reflected most profoundly for me as a kid. Since I didn't get it all, I just knew that my dad cared about people and was always, he always knew people's stories. And so I realize now that that's because he always asked questions and listened and cared.
I want to ask about your military service.
Absolutely.
So you grew up in Fairfax, you went to NC State. And yes. Correct me if I have the timing right, but after you get out of school, you decide to join the Marines.
So there's a little bit of a delay in there where I literally had to live my biggest life goal out at that point. And I am an avid skier.
Okay.
And so my big ambition upon graduating from college a little early in December was to find a way to ski 100 days in a season.
Oh, wow.
And it was actually my dad who really encouraged me, right? I have a lot of motivation and I'm a hard worker. And my dad's common refrain to me growing up was, hey, bud, take time to stop and smell the roses. And so when I ended up finishing school early, which was a little by accident, my dad was like, go do something fun. You know, take some time.
So where'd you go?
I went out to Aspen, Colorado, only because I had a couple sorority sisters that were living out there. And they said, hey, you can crash on our extra room for a little bit of money and just have some fun out here.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, I had a blast. And so I actually worked in local news because I'd been working in journalism in college for the ABC affiliate. So I got a job at Aspen TV 12.
So were you skiing and you were on TV?
Oh, my gosh. It was hysterical. Yes. So it was a very tiny local television station. And to make ends meet in Aspen, Colorado, you can guess I had to have multiple jobs. Mm-hmm. And so I used to tape my newscast around 5 or 6 o'clock. And then I would go to my night job, which was delivering room service.
5 or 6 a.m.?
5 or 6 p.m.
P.m., okay.
And then I would go to my night job delivering room service. And so they would rerun my newscast at 10. And oftentimes I would be in people's room delivering a tray of food while my newscast was
like,
rerunning.
Wait,
yes. Every now and then people made the connection. Yeah. But I would usually try to exit stage left pretty quickly.
It's like your head would explode.
Yeah, <You're> totally.
Crashing in on their reality.
Yeah, totally. But so yeah, I got to keep my hand in journalism in a real grassroots way, but I did meet my goal. I was able to ski 100 plus days that season, and I would meet my husband in Colorado as well too. So it was a trip that really ended up having lasting impact on my life.
So after living that reality, how do you just shut that down and say, I'm going to go join the Marines? Like, it seems like two very different.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And I would think that too, when I was in Quantico and in training, and Marine Corps training's intense. Hollywood does a good job of giving us that perspective, yet to experience it, it's like nothing I'll ever experience again. But I do remember when I was looking for moments of brevity, I would say, wow, a year ago, I was hanging out in Aspen, Colorado.
This is not Aspen.
Now I'm dug in the defense in Quantico, Virginia, fighting, you know, the Centrillion Rebel Force, which was our fictional enemy during training. So, yeah, the irony was not lost on me. Yet the Marine Corps was who I am in my heart. And maybe I didn't know that when I was all of 21 and signed the paperwork. Yet the through line in my life is service. And how do you step up and add value to other people? And I, without verbalizing at the time and connecting the dots, I knew I wanted to be part of something bigger than myself. And I loved the no guarantees. The Marine Corps basically said, hey, it's a 10-week job interview. Attrition's the mission. Come here to OCS, Officer Candidate School, and we'll see. Well, it's a screening process. We'll see if you have what it takes to lead Marines. And that no guarantees just really appealed to my sense of challenge and adventure.
So when you heard that, you were like, let's do this.
Yeah, I was like, all right, I'm in. And 61 people started in my platoon and only 16 graduated.
Wow.
So it was a phenomenal experience. And candidly, the 10 weeks at Officer Candidate School was not the most difficult. You will go on to 6 months, and that's really where I was tested to the core.
And do you go elsewhere for that, for the 6 months?
No, still in Quantico. Okay. And then after that, the worldwide deployments began.
Wow.
But it was a great experience. I mean, this is an amazing country. I am so proud to be an American. And when you get to serve in the armed forces, and today that's a rare choice, only about 1%. And I think that shows a strong democracy, that we only need 1% to serve in the military. Yet I'm so glad that I had that experience.
There's something, I mean, I did not serve, but there's something
when I hear from those that did, like the way you describe it, there's a service aspect, but even just an affinity in the ways that those experiences shaped you that I think is really unique and not, I mean, there is 1%, but that means 99% haven't had that experience. So, yes. Yeah, thank you, I guess.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And now with the work I do today in leadership development, I understand it more from an academic perspective. I mean, it was a true heat experience.
Right.
I really got to be tested every facet of myself, physically, emotionally, mentally. And to do that in your early 20s, research now shows your brain actually wires differently because of those experiences.
Neural pathways,
exactly, right? So I feel the Marine Corps literally formed me, and I am so fortunate that I had that experience at such a young age.
And when you were in the service, where all did you go? What did you do? What were the X's and O's of your time in service?
I went all over the world. So I was, I raised my hand for deployments. I asked to be forward deployed. So I was stationed in Okinawa, Japan, and I deployed to hotspots in Indonesia at the time. I deployed a little bit of Persian Gulf time, mostly on ship. And then I did some amazing humanitarian deployments as well, or participating in exercises in Korea, got some vacation time in Australia. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Western Pacific is a large region, and we were present in a lot of places, and certainly were during my time of service in the late 90s in that area.
Yeah. Is there a moment or a story that exemplifies or something that sticks with you? I know there's so many, and your experience is probably very rich, but I just wonder if there's anything that sticks with you from that time more prominent than some others.
Oh, you know, there's so many
where to begin
stories, right? There really are. But I think that they, you know, the common themes were you were given a mission, yet you weren't told how to do it. Mm. You were given the what needed to be accomplished. And as Marine officers, we were taught two priorities: accomplish the mission and troop welfare. And they weren't always necessarily in that order. Sometimes troop welfare came to the forefront. And so I think that's the common thread of all of those stories would be being asked to do things that if someone had shown you a highlight reel, you would never have believed that was you before you had the experience, yet given a lot of support and then a lot of autonomy to make things happen. Mm. And I think that that's surprising to people about the military. We tend to think it's black, white, orders, top down.
Right.
Yet there is so much opportunity for creativity during my time in uniform.
That's so interesting. I mean, it's almost like saying, here are your constraints. This is the sandbox that you have to operate in. This is the goal.
It also made me a global citizen long before the move was really there to be that, because I was based in Japan, but I would frequently, I mean, Thailand, Korea, you know, Australia, I would go to different places to do the work. And I, at a very young age, got to set the agenda of what work was valuable and how I could be helpful. So
you were a global citizen before that was a thing.
Yeah, before I even knew that was a thing to be, but it was great to have that experience. So it's, and I think, you know, I mean, the other thing is courage, right? It's not always easy, and it can be scary at times. Serving in the armed forces, you putting your life on the line. And I think that recognizing how, as people, being courageous is not about dismissing your fears. It's really about facing your fears, naming them, and moving forward in spite of them. And I think that I got a chance to really wrestle with that several times. And that was part of forming who I was, too.
Yeah, I think it's easy to think of courage as the absence of fear, but I think courage is more about acting in the face of fear, even though it's still there.
Leadership for the real world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like we are feeling beings. And so I think, though, when you look at my life later, some of the big milestones, like having twin daughters or running for a public office or being the primary caregiver for my grandmother, those things could seem really scary to take on.
Yeah.
Yet to me, I had learned how to embrace my fears maybe differently, or had fortunately had opportunities to do that.
I want to ask you about your grandmother.
Yeah.
Is it Nana?
Yes,
is that right?
It is Nana. Blaine, I love how much you have done research. It just really touches my heart to know that you know Nana.
Thank you. That's Ben Tees is our research expert here.
Yeah, hats off to you, Ben.
In-house. But I want to ask, so correct me if I get this sort of flow right, but you come out of the service.
Mm-hmm.
You're young. The world's your oyster.
You could
go skiing at Aspen. You could get a real job.
And I was so fit. Oh, my gosh.
You were just jacked.
Yes,
there's no telling how many push-ups you could have done.
Yeah, let me live in my glory days for a moment, right? Oh, I need to recapture that.
But at this point in time, your family was thinking of putting Nana in assisted living.
Yes.
What happened next?
Yeah, so I was, let's see, that was the summer of 2000. And I, you know, I loved my grandmother. I am her baby granddaughter. I was her baby granddaughter. And we were always really close. And it just had gotten to the point, she was in her late 80s, where living on her own independently was becoming less and less of a safe option. And so my family got together, and I was transitioning out of the military. I had gotten a job at an amazing software company. I was getting ready to start law school, and we were looking for options. And so I said, hey, you know, I'll stay with Nana for a bit and help her clean out the house and help her transition to assisted living. And I've got the flexibility. Again, we always had a really close relationship. And so I said, I'll do this. And the funny thing is literally days after moving in with her and getting ready for this big year of transitioning Nana, Nana set me straight and said, you know, I'm not leaving this house. And I'm not going to assisted living. You know, her classic line was, they can take me out of here in a pine box. And she used to remind me of that, right? So Nana was definitely up for a lot.
She's got
more
some
adventure.
Tenacity.
Yeah. Oh, Nana, totally. I come from tough stock. And so, you know, what began as 1 year helping her transition ended up being an 8-year journey.
Oh, wow.
And I would eventually get recalled back to the Marine Corps after 9/11. Nana came with me. We moved to Virginia Beach.
Wait,
I got married.
Yeah. How does that happen?
My husband moved in with Nana and me. You know?
So how, like, after 9/11 happens, you go back into the service and you're married and you take Nana with you? Like, how?
So I wasn't married at the time.
Okay.
And I literally, I mean, this was obviously unexpected. 9/11 for us as a nation was unexpected. I was, you know, living the dream, working in the software industry before the bubble burst, the dot-com bomb, right? It was a heyday.
Right.
And 9/11 happens. About 3 weeks later, I get the first call from the Marine Corps. And I had stayed in the reserves. I loved the Marine Corps. Uh-huh. I loved having a part of it in my life. But my generation was never expecting a recall or anything similar to the Vietnam era generation.
Right.
I got the first call about 3 weeks after 9/11, and I had a very small specialty. I was a public affairs officer, and based on what they had learned from the previous Gulf War, then the growth of media, they knew that they were going to need public affairs officers. Hmm. And so they basically gave me a heads up and said, you're on a very short list, and we're likely going to recall you. You need to start getting your life in order. And it gives me chills to think about it right now, because, you know, being in that mindset and not too far out of the Marine Corps at the time, when something like 9/11 happened, I mean, that's what you train and prepare for. You know, I wanted to be of value, yet I also had my life going. I was in law school. I was in a great job. I had the responsibility of taking care of my grandmother. But so they brought me down to, they allowed me to wait till December. So I finished up the semester. A lot of paperwork had to be completed. They were getting congressional authorizations to do the involuntary recalls and all of the legal procedures. And so I was stationed in Norfolk, Virginia, because that's where they had part of Joint Forces Command, because there was no Homeland Security. All these entities didn't exist. And so there were some, I guess, dusty old plans that said, in the event of a domestic threat, we're going to stand up a command here in Norfolk, Virginia. And so I went there, and the war hadn't started yet. It wouldn't start till March. And that's just how it went. They allowed me to take my grandmother until I would be deployed. They, you know, they said, okay, at this point you can bring her with you. And I mean, it was just hysterical and, you know, patriotic all at the same time. And so I ended up, when the war started, working on overnight time, doing analysis work. So I worked on Gulf time. So I would work overnight here at the stateside. And I went to law school during the day.
And
so it all worked out, right? And then caring for Nana in between. And at that point, she was still fairly independent. I could set her up for the day and spend time with her at key times. But she loved Virginia Beach. She enjoyed it, as it ended up being this whole renaissance for her. We, you know, we ended up having a great experience there. Now, recall was only supposed to be 6 months. I ended up being stop-loss a couple times, and it ended up being 2 years.
Wow.
But that was just the way the events were moving, right?
And you were in law school and caring for Nana.
It was a crazy time of my life, right?
But
it was a great time of my life. And I was just thankful to all the people that stepped up to help me make that happen. But it was, thanks for asking about it. It's actually positive to reminisce now, and it was a chance to be a part of something and to see things happen from the inside, that it was a great opportunity to serve again.
Yeah. Lead star.
lead star. So you
have
my
day,
baby.
You have a day job. It's a leadership consulting business.
Yeah, yeah. She's grown up so much.
Yeah. What led you to start Lead Star?
My first child.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about it.
So Lead Star is a leadership development consulting firm. We like to say we help our clients get better results through people. We're a boutique firm. The majority of our work is referral based. And we literally have worked with the best of the best, Facebook, Google, Walmart, FedEx. I mean, we've had amazing clients. And over the last 15 years, again, I think about as a child learning planning and zoning from my father, I've gotten the chance to learn leadership from some of the greatest minds our world has to offer in helping and supporting them and developing their organizations. And so I love it. I love the work I do. I love writing about leadership. And we started the company candidly because my business partner, Angie, is also a Marine. We realized that we'd had that very rare experience, going back to what we were talking about earlier, right, that only 1% serve in the military, and we knew how valuable the nuts and bolts leadership development experience is and can be for people, right? I think there are two skills that are really undertaught in our American culture. One is leadership. How do I actually lead, influence, and inspire people? But the other is financial literacy, right? The nuts and bolts of managing money. And I think we've come far as a country in teaching those skills, especially since the downturn of 2008. Right. And I'd like to say LeadStar is doing our part to help people find practical ways to develop their leadership skills. And it's interesting. I mean, with some of the current events and the tough things we've seen, the recent school shooting in Florida, and some of the tougher headlines we see as a nation today, I think at the root of it are people skills and relationship building, and how do we work together better and identify needs in each other better and serve and add value. So I feel like our work is adding, you know, that small value in the universe.
Yeah, and I think, and Mike, you obviously know about it in deeper ways than I do, but I think often when we talk about leadership, I think there's a very American conception that it's the sage on the stage and we're going to take the hill and, you know, I've got the title and I'm sort of my way or the highway. And I think that's
absolutely
antithetical to how you all think about leadership. And that's really refreshing.
Yeah, we're very much focused on leadership isn't about power, prestige, notoriety, positional authority, the fancy corner office, right? Those things aren't bad or wrong. And if you desire them, learning how to influence and inspire, right? We define a leader as someone who influences outcomes and inspires others. And so if you want those attributes of success, by all means, go for them. Yet that's not at the heart of leadership. Leadership is how you behave. How do you show up? And how do you add value and influence and inspire?
I would follow that person.
Nice.
That's somebody I want to follow.
Exactly, right? And that's the surprise about the Marine Corps, right? You think it's command and control, but it's not at all. When your life is in danger, you need to trust the person that's asking you to do something that you don't know if you're capable of doing, right? Mm. And so that's why the Marine Corps taught us behavior-based leadership. You had to earn the privilege of that rank, and you had to show up strong so that you could influence and inspire.
Yeah.
And that lesson was lasting from that time in uniform.
So you grew up in Fairfax.
Yeah,
you
DC,
now live
DC
in
DC area kid.
In Henrico. What brought you to Richmond?
Totally by choice.
Okay.
My husband and I mean, this is totally nerdy, but I'll tell you straight up. We made a spreadsheet and we were trying to figure out what we wanted in a community.
It was like a ranking system.
It was, and not super sophisticated because I'm not very good at math, but it was a ranking system, and I have the freedom with the work I do of living wherever I'd like. And we just had heard such great things about this area. We had a lot of RVA friends that had been trying to recruit us here for years. And so now they always tell us, you should have moved sooner. And they were right. But this area had everything that we were looking for, right? A decent cost of living, mobility. And when I say mobility, lack of congestion, those types of things that make quality of life good. And just good people. And, you know, we found all of that here, and great schools. Our kids were in kindergarten. My twin girls were in the middle of kindergarten when we moved, so I felt a little guilty as a mom doing that. But it was, I think, to a really great school system here in Henrico, and that's what drew us.
Yeah, and you've been here how long?
We moved in 2012.
Okay, great. Yeah. And here you are. I mean, you spoke to some of them, but I think, what were some of your early impressions of Henrico County and the Richmond region more generally? I think you outline some of the amenities, but they're obviously, it's not all rosy.
I mean, my general impressions, though, were very rosy, in the sense that there's just such a strong sense of community here. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the first groups I got engaged with was the We Heart Harley and Friends Foundation, a foundation built around a little girl and her you know, challenges, having a lot of different health issues. And this foundation grew to help other families with medically fragile children. But watching the community come together literally months after I got here for a fundraiser and just seeing that true grassroots connection, I mean, that was my first impression of this area. People really cared, and they could, the area was connected enough and small enough that they could put that care into action pretty quickly and do great things for their fellow citizens. So I had a really rosy impression coming here, and I still do. But I also had some, you know, different impressions that would come that, you know, I was really more in the South than I had ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Northern Virginia is different, and I tend to think
which
of Richmond
is, it's
as
not
the
far, but
gateway
yeah.
to the South, yeah. right? So there were some things maybe a little bit with gender and race that I started to notice. I was in a fender bender pretty soon after moving here, and it was me. I rear-ended an African-American man, and, you know, how he responded to that, you know, thinking that he was at fault, and, you know, just it was a very different, you know, I was apologizing profusely and I was the one at fault. Yet it was an interesting race dynamic that I hadn't encountered in Northern Virginia, and it just raised an eyebrow. Again, just little things like that, and even some things with gender. I mean, I guess I'm atypical for the average woman, having served in the Marine Corps and those types of things. And I don't tend to notice gender barriers as much, but I started to see some things here that just told me that, hey, I'm in just a different community, and I have to figure out how I can be valuable here.
Yeah. I want to ask about your run for public office.
Oh, sure.
So, absolutely.
It's really easy to talk about it now, now that it's in the rearview mirror, but
right.
I'll say it was tough. It was very difficult.
Yeah, what motivated you to run? Because Dick Glover had mm-hmm. your seat. He was a Republican.
Yes,
he passed
right.
away in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, there were basically two Republicans, two Democrats. And I don't want to, like, overstate the role. I know that parties matter, but...
Sure.
But I'm just curious, when that chair opened up, what made you say, like, huh, maybe I could make a run for... being the supervisor of the Brooklyn district.
I can tell you honestly, if someone had told me at the beginning of 2017 that you're going to be an elected official by the end of the year, I would have been like, nope, I don't think so. It wasn't in my plans at all. Yet 2016 had a profound impact on me, and it's not a partisan impact, right? But the national election, the Clinton-Trump presidential election, I just felt like our country had reached a pretty tough low when it came to the dialogue on leadership in our nation. And, you know, when you write a best-selling book on leadership, people are always asking your opinion. And during election season, it was no different. And my business partner, Angie Morgan, and I gave our opinion freely. I mean, we just chatted it up from the sidelines. And, you know, looking back after how everything worked out, I felt like we didn't really do anything. You know, literally, we just enjoyed that comfort, you know, vantage point.
You're saying we, you and Angie.
Yeah, Angie and I being pundits and chatting up
the
leadership.
You were on the sidelines.
Yeah, but we didn't roll up our sleeves and work. And everything, all the outcomes surprised us. They surprised a lot of people. And we made a commitment in late 2016 that, you know, we owed it to this country. We had served this country and took that service very seriously. And we needed, I mean, our country built us. I am a product of the American taxpayer. And how could we add value in new ways, in different ways, and not just talk about it? You know, talk is cheap. And we knew we both wanted to get more engaged in the political process. And so we had made that commitment at the end of 2016. And I didn't know that Mr. Glover would pass away. And so in February, when he did, and when the party came to me and asked me to run, my initial response was no. I wanted to be involved, but that was seemed
why?
Like a lot, right?
Yeah, why?
Just because I wanted anything I do, I want to try to do it well. And I didn't know if I'd have the bandwidth to be of service in a way that I thought was responsible. Yet I shared that with Angie and all that was going on. And she's like, how could you not do this? Like, our, you know, the company will be fine. We will support this. So I was very fortunate to be in a position. And, you know, today I'm only the second woman ever to serve on the Board of Supervisors. I'm the youngest member, and I'm also the only mom of school-age children. And I can see why most folks with my demographic background don't have the opportunity. So I'm very grateful that I have a company that's very flexible, and we have an all-star cast of employees that have picked up a lot since I've chosen to engage in public service.
Yeah. I want to ask about the election mailers that
sure,
were...
Sure, yeah. It was a tough campaign.
So for those that weren't following it closely, so during the election, there were a set of misleading mailers that were going out. So they were created by the Republican Party, things like Protect Henrico, you know, linking you with, in some pretty stark ways, with LeVar Stoney. some of them appeared to have his skin darkened and just and even just not great Photoshop jobs. You know, and I think there were some racial undertones which were denied. There was one picture of you driving a bus full of cash that I mean, I think it just painted a picture that was very stark that I think was probably playing on fear a little bit. But I'm curious, like, from where you sit, what did you make of those mailers? How did that impact you when you went home at night?
Yeah, no, thanks. I appreciate you asking the question. So a couple things I knew for sure when I decided to run for office. One, I was going to be my full self, and I'm a very, very positive person. And I really believe in talking about ideas, not focusing on insults. So I knew I was going to run a positive campaign, and I was going to focus on my experiences and my policy ideas. I would not go negative. So I vowed that right at the start. And, you know, it surprised the heck out of me. I mean, this was a local race. I was outspent 2-1. And I also, almost everything that my opponent's team spent on was negative advertising, right? The type of marketing that you're, you know, sharing those details of, those mailers. And so it was a real, I mean, I shouldn't say I was blindsided, but let's be honest, it really did surprise me.
Yeah.
Yet, candidly, I'm really grateful for it from a personal growth standpoint, because it allowed me to express who I was and continue to stay that course in some really tough times that I could never have created on my own. If we're just trying to do the right thing, it really put me in a pressure cooker situation, because a lot of people wanted me to fire back, right?
Yeah, that's what I was gonna ask.
I was baited, right? Come on,
you're
a Marine.
We gotta hit back.
You're a Marine, you know, hit them where it hurts. But that wasn't what I set out to do. And I also believe that's not what voters want, right? Voters want us to focus on the issues, and voters want us to bring positive decorum back to politics in America. It's far too important. And now that I'm inside and I'm an elected official, local government matters. It's, you know, it's very valuable. And I think people need to keep paying attention. Yet, I think politicians don't give people much to pay attention to. And so I really just wanted to run a campaign that folks could engage with and be proud to show their kids. And I didn't realize how much of an impact running a positive campaign would have until after we won and people came up to me and shared those thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing too is it's fortitude. You know, I think about my opponent, Bob Witte. He's a nice man. I got to know him. We spent a lot of time together, particularly on election day. I think he just got caught up in something that was bigger than him, and it was hard to stop the freight train, right? And I think that we have to stand up to change politics today. We have to express our values through how we're running campaigns and how we're meeting the needs of voters.
Which I think speaks to your character. I don't know that you would, I don't think you could claim that, but I think when people are whispering in your ear, we need to hit back, and you say, no, I'm going to stick to my guns, I'm not going to sling mud, that's refreshing.
Yeah.
And you won handily by, what, 9 points?
I think it was actually 11 points.
Okay.
And we were expected to squeak it out, either candidate, by maybe 1%.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I give credit to a ton of other people, right? I mean, I had the most motivating volunteers, starting with my husband, who was amazing, and a great team of consultants that worked with me. I mean, this was a total team effort. And let's be real, there's a lot going on in society, and I feel like Virginia was the first chance for people to really express themselves and say, hey, we do not like the direction that our country is heading, and we're going to show up, we're going to turn out, and we're going to ask for change.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I could say this was Courtney Lynch won by 11 points, but it was really the mandate for change, and I think the endorsement of positivity in an issues-focused campaign. I mean, I picked up more votes than the governor in my district.
Hmm.
And so that means people were willing to cross aisles for me. And that's what I stand for. Bipartisan, working together, interdependence, building bridges. And it was exciting to see that others believed in that too.
Yeah, you're riding the wave.
Absolutely.
So I want to ask about that. I mean, there was a big shift that happened nationally, certainly, but especially here in Virginia at the state level in the election. Democrats picked up 15 seats in the House. 11 of those were won by women. You know, you had Asian American, LGBT, Latina, just the new representation that I think you've spoken about. In a lot of previous Republican strongholds, those are no longer in a lot of places, particularly because of some of the changing demographics in the places we live. What does it feel like for you to be a part of that sea change? You know, what's it like for you to be a woman in a leadership role publicly today?
Sure. I mean, it's a true honor to serve in this capacity, right? And to be entrusted with the responsibility. And again, Henrico County, $1.2 billion of budget. And I would often ask people on the campaign trail what they thought the county budget was. And they would give answers ranging from 20 to 50 million, right? I mean, people are surprised the impact local government has. But to be a part of diversity in government and this big wave of diversity that washed into our offices here in Virginia is powerful for me, because I really believe in diversity for business case reasons, right? In the end, it's about results. And when your government bodies are more representative of the groups they that they're standing up there to represent, I mean, that's Jeffersonian. That was the vision of democracy. A strong democracy is when the people really are represented by their elected officials. So that was exciting to me, from the impact of results I know it's going to have in the Commonwealth for years to come.
Yeah, and I think to say it back to you, I think when we think about ethnicity, gender, even just the spread of poverty in the Richmond region, that diversity isn't just for the sake of diversity, but if we need to solve problems for these people, they need to have a voice in the conversation, almost from like an empathy standpoint of like, how
absolutely
can I and help you solve your problem? Yeah.
Let's talk socioeconomics, right? I mean, that's another thing is candidates that ran, that it was a tremendous financial sacrifice for them. I mean, I had candidates on the trail that literally, you know, it was the 13th and they weren't getting paid till the 15th and they were out of resources. And I think having folks that have lived more of a middle class or lower middle class existence in office is powerful. So we can't neglect the socioeconomic diversity as well, because there are gaps in our society and we need people on both sides of the chasm to help bridge them.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for women who are either currently leaders or aspiring leaders?
Well, I mean, my biggest advice is recognize that you are a leader, right? We can lead from where we're at. I mean, if you're a mom, if you're a volunteer, if you're a senior executive, if you're an elected official, I mean, we all have opportunities to influence and inspire. And so I would just really encourage, I think at times women focus on what they can't do without recognizing what they can do. And, you know, I'm not a rocket scientist. I mean, I think the only thing that maybe makes me a little special is that courage and that willingness to try. And through that, being able to step forward and have that courage to take a risk, I've been able to learn so much. So we don't need to know everything when we raise our hand and take on a new opportunity. We just have to have that courage to try and that integrity to learn from those that have gone before.
I want to ask about transparency
in
leadership. So you've talked a lot about this, but I think it's this idea, and you've spoken to it a little bit, of being who you are as a leader, right? Like, taking responsibility when you make a mistake, owning up to things. And my sense is that the higher the office, it seems like the less we, the public, may actually want that. I don't think we always like reward.
Like we want to kind of buy into the image, right?
If somebody makes a mistake, you're like, oh, they're incompetent, rather than,
dignity and grace,
I really appreciate the transparency. Yeah. It's like, we're going to say, oh, this person just can't do the job. I don't think we always reward elected officials for being fully transparent. And perhaps it's easier like in business or in your family where you can say, hey, I made a mistake, like help me out. But I think it's, I'm just wondering to what degree does transparency still matter today in 2018? And if so, like, is that actually possible as an elected official? Are there degrees? Like, how do you think about that now that you're...
So, Blaine, we're going to see, right? Because, I mean, I can't lead through a facade, because to me, that's not leadership. Right? That's something else. That's ego. That's arrogance. You know, I'm here to try to add value, but I'm a fallible human being and I'm going to make mistakes left and right. I think the key is, you know, we had an expression in Marine Corps, you know, you're walking point, right? I'm walking point, meaning I might get shot. Mm-hmm. I'm out there trying to do something different. I'm trying to stay positive. I'm trying to be authentic. I'm certainly confident and I'm working every day to become more and more competent at the role. Yet, I'm also going to be accountable. When I make a mistake, I'm going to own it. I'm going to accept responsibility, and I'm going to work to resolve it, right? I'm not going to dwell on it. So it's going to be interesting to see. And my whole desire in running for public office is to evolve the system. And so sometimes when you're the first person or one of the early people stepping up to evolve or try to bring about change and try to be that change, you're not very successful. You don't get very far. You know what? That's okay. I don't, you know, I look at times in my life where I had a lot of ambition to reach high levels. And I like to describe myself now and as a post-ego leader. There were definitely seasons of my career where I was in it to win it for me, right? Yeah. I mean, it was all about, yeah, I'm cool and look, look at me. But it's like you reach some highs or you reach some goals and you realize like that's so empty.
Yeah.
And I'm in it for something bigger than me. And I realize I might be only carrying the baton half a lap of the 4-lap race and I'm going to hand it off to somebody else. And that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay because I feel proud of what my team and I did this year and last year running for office. And I feel proud of what I'm trying to bring to local government. And if it's, you know, if I'm not right for the job or the job's not right for me or I'm not the best person, I'm probably going to be the first person to say that and help to try to build succession to bring that next person along.
Yeah. And I think there's something refreshing about that because I think it reflects a recognition that you're a part of a greater whole.
Yeah.
And I think too, it there's just a recognition that this is a long game.
Yeah.
Right. Like just Richmond has been around for a long time. It will continue. Like
sure.
You and many others are one person amongst a line of leaders. And I think people trying to do their part.
Yeah. I've learned a new term lately. I came from one of my clients, a patient sense of urgency. I know it sounds like an oxymoron, but that's what I keep at the forefront. And yeah. I'll admit, I'm not very patient. I tend to kind of gravitate towards the sense of urgency piece, mm-hmm. but this is a chance to develop patience, right? And that progress, a couple steps ahead, a couple steps back. And yeah, that's the human journey we're all on.
Trying to move the ball forward. I've got just a couple questions and then we'll wrap.
Sure, but yeah. Thank you. I really, really loved these insightful questions.
Yeah, I want to ask about your impatience as it applies to Henrico
yeah.
County particularly.
Yeah,
so
okay.
what are the challenges that you see and what are the things that you're impatient about that where you want to see some progress?
Yeah, so first of all, there are amazing sparks on the Henrico County team, right? And I use the term spark. That's my book talking about people that affect change and are talented and competent. I have really just been blown away by the amount of commitment people on the Henrico County team have. Yet also mindset, right?
Mm-hmm.
This mindset towards the future and this mindset towards growth is needed. And what I'm talking about when I say that is, you know, we as a government agency have to embrace change and we have to be willing to look at our gaps. And I think what I've seen in local government is there's a lot of pride, and rightfully so. What people do with limited resources every day is pride worthy and courageous.
Right.
Yet the most elite organizations look at the gaps and they look at where they're not meeting the mark and they want to be measured. They're not afraid they're not going to measure up. They know they're not, and they're looking for how they can be better. And so I'd like to see the mindset evolve more in the county towards that real open embracing of development and growth and us moving away from, yes, there are things we do well and we can celebrate them. And that's important, certainly. Yet we need to really be looking at the gaps and trying to solve them.
Mm-hmm.
And the great news is there are a lot of creative minds within Henrico that are figuring out what is the new era of government going
yeah.
to be.
Final question. Dramatic pause.
Dramatic
pause. It's not that good.
Dun.
No, but
cue the drum roll.
Yeah, when you, like, from a 30,000 foot level, Richmond
yeah, yeah.
as a region, you think about Henrico, Chesterfield, the city, Hanover. I mean, you could go out to the counties
stronger as a region.
Yeah, from a regional perspective, how do you think about regionalism and where is your hope for, like, what do you hope for?
There's great footing. I think there's a great, I mean, this community is interconnected in more ways than the average person sees. So I've been excited to see how much interconnection there is between all the municipalities here in the region. I mean, I just see a tremendously bright future. I mean, we have what the world wants, an amazing quality of life here. And more people are going to be coming here. The secret's out. And so we're just going to be attracting more great minds. But this is an amazing place to be, and this is an amazing time to be here. Yet we're going to have challenges, right? I think of my father in 1970 staring down the barrel of growth in Fairfax County. They didn't even know what was coming. And I think now, because we're a mid-sized region, we can look at other larger regions and see what's coming. We just have to get out in front of it and keep working together to resolve, anticipate, and resolve those challenges.
Yeah.
Courtney Lynch, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, thank you so much. I just really, truly enjoyed this. And just thanks for the amazing questions and the chance to share my thoughts with listeners.
Well, you're welcome. We appreciate it. Best of luck to you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Yeah. Likewise, keep doing the podcast.
Thanks.
True value.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool. That's it. As always, you can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Big shout out to Ben Teese this week. He's a new member of our podcast team. He's basically a one-man research department, and he's going to be helping out with the show. Our theme is by No BS Brass. Chris Payne, our producer, is the feeling you get when you wake up a little bit early, but you actually feel rested. Thanks for listening.